Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. We're talking to leaders across the cell and gene therapy industry and telling you more about Ori's mission to manufacture brighter futures. I'm Jason Foster, the CEO of Ori Biotech, and I'll be the host for today's podcast. Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. This is your host, Jason Foster. Today, I've got Daniel Gibson with me. Daniel is the Director of Cell and Gene Therapy Services at Anthony Nolan. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I think a great place to start would be just to tell our audience a little bit more about Anthony Nolan. I'm not sure everyone listening will know your organization, but both about the kind of history of the charity and but also your own history, how you got to where you are as the Director of Cell and Gene Therapy. I think it'd be a great place to start.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. So as you may or may not know, the Anthony Nolan is, we're a charity. We manage the UK stem cell register and, you know, we support the collection of donor materials and delivery to patients in need of a stem cell transplant anywhere in the world. The organization was incepted in 1974 by Shirley Nolan, who set it up because of her son, who had Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome. The only known cure at the time would have been a stem cell transplant. Mm. Unfortunately, there was no related members of the family that could donate to Anthony. So she looked and she'd heard that there'd been an unrelated transplant in another part of the world. So she went to the NHS, went to a doctor and tried to find what the solution would be for her son. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there was no registry at the time. There was no support for unrelated donor matching. So she set up the organization. She did recruitment drives, and she got an overwhelming support from the public that also wanted to try and save Anthony's life. Mm. And that was the origin of the organization and where we've come from. And it's grown from strength to strength since then. The organization has constantly and consistently innovated as the industry has innovated as well. So as we started to learn more about the importance of donor-patient matching, we created the Anthony Nolan H&I labs, the histocompatibility and immunogenetics labs. Mm-hmm. We invested into the research institute, the Anthony Nolan Research Institute, which is enabled us to better understand the complexity of the patient donor matching. And we've subsequently continued to grow. So we've got patient services and now most recently, the cell and gene therapy services, which I work at. Mm-hmm. So my background to the organization actually started around 14 years ago. So my background was I started working in the cord blood bank, had multiple roles within the organization, from a scientist to supervising the clean rooms to research and development. And now I've got the fantastic opportunity to carry that work on in cell and gene therapies.
So interested to learn a bit more about the kind of cell therapy side of the house where you reside these days. Obviously, you know, breakthrough research is taking place in lots of different places, in universities and academic institutions around the world, private companies, of course, but also many charities. And, you know, popping into my mind places like maybe Dana-Farber and other types of charitable organizations, PICE in the U.S. And we know that many charities are having a big positive impact in this space. So I'd love to learn more about, you know, the activities specifically in that area, and how Anthony Nolan is advancing stem cell research.
As I mentioned, we have our own research institute that was established 25 years ago. I think there are a few key areas within our research portfolio that we focus on. There's the molecular side, which is the HLA, as I mentioned before, understanding the complexity between donor and patient matching. I think that's going to play a really key role moving forward for the industry as well. We've seen a number of areas where pharmacogenetics is being employed for small molecules and biologics. Yeah, so we're working on the molecular side, so understanding the complexity between donor and patient matching and HLA. And we have a fantastic research group and bioinformatics group that are constantly trying to learn more about HLA and how we can better select. And as I mentioned, the cell and gene therapies are personalized medicine. They're, and each one is very individualized. So for us to be able to understand and predict outcome, the more we understand about the complexity of the individuals going in, whether that's the patient or whether that's the donor, the easier it'll become to be able to predict outcomes. And I think HLA and biomarkers have got a critical role to play as we profile and understand the patients that we're trying to treat. Another area that we focus on is on our with our cell therapy group. So our cell therapy group are doing cutting edge research into some key areas such as NK cell biology and stem cell biology and hematopoietic graft versus host disease and the post transplant complications and contributing quite significantly to the industry in that regard as well. And then though, I would say the other area that we focus on is partnerships. So, and I think this is really important for the industry and for science in general. So the leveraging the expertise that we have and our unique position as a donor organization with access to over 850,000 donors, all HLA typed. We've got a unique position to be able to help answer some of those critical questions on the scalability and optimizing your materials for new advanced therapies.
Yes, interesting. You mentioned a little bit about the charity's work with both patients and donors. You know, there's kind of both sides of the equation. What are your thoughts on the kind of major barriers to access for patients today, you know, to this new generation of cell and gene therapies? Obviously, the very first allogeneic product was approved not that long ago in Europe in the cell therapy space for a relatively small indication. But we know we've got ambitions to address larger patient populations and things like, you know, solid tumors and other indications. What's your view of the landscape on kind of what's holding us back from achieving that bigger vision that we're all hopeful for?
For the patient access perspective, in respect to the social determinants of health, there are many. We know that there are those from poorer backgrounds or from deprived areas or ethnic minority groups are less likely to access healthcare, for example. And this obviously reduces the likelihood of being diagnosed and potentially being referred for treatments and transplants. This is true in the transplant setting. So we can recognize that will be true moving forward into the advanced therapies as well. That's also the same for people with learning disabilities, poor mental health, and language or literacy barriers. So, and I think these are really key areas that we need to understand and overcome. As an organization, we want to ensure that everyone gets a chance for a transplant and everyone who needs one can access what they need. From finding a 10 out of 10 match from a transplant perspective is obviously going to be very, very difficult. Not everyone's going to have an available match. And so we want to make sure that we deal with the inequity that exists in the access. And that when we started to explore that, we recognized that it was far more complex than simply having access to a donor. There are a host of different things that we need to take into consideration, such as the background, the social economic background of the patients and their particular financial situations, for example. The cost of undergoing a transplant can be a potential barrier. So not being able to work for a prolonged period of time, long distance to travel to transplant centers, and lack of family or care support in place. All of those things can have an impact on the patient experience and ultimately the patient outcome. And these are all barriers for the access, but also the ability to strive once given. As an organization, we've got a fantastic patient services team that are doing a lot of work to try and understand this and overcome some of those barriers, supporting patients on their journey, and very, very importantly, working with local hospitals and to understand those pathways and advocate for patients and ensure that there are systems and processes in place to support them post-transplant or post-treatment.
Yeah, it makes sense. I was reading some data from Be The Match in the US, and I don't know how similar or not their organization might be to what you do. I'd be interested in your view on that also, but there was some statistics around the matching for particular ethnic or racial minorities might be extremely difficult, like in the low teens percentages might have certain minority groups might have matches. Is that, did I read that right? Is that kind of, you know, there are not only kind of this quote unquote kind of generic pool of donors that we're trying to service, but to match certain patients with certain characteristics, you need a much closer set of, I don't know, biological matching, if I understand it correctly.
Yeah, exactly right. So we're within each kind of demographic, we may have different levels of known variability. So it's not necessarily the same across all different demographics. Mm-hmm. So we know, for example, for Caucasians, the disparity in HLA, and so the potential matches that are likely to occur are defined and well known and understood. And so we can create a register that's big enough to meet those requirements. And so we actually have quite a strong statistical hit rate for Caucasian patients, for example. Mm. When it comes to other groups, harder to reach groups, then the disparity is totally different. Right. And it's not necessarily the same. For example, the Black African population in the UK, for example, may have a very different spread than to Black African in America, for example. So it is, as you get to minority groups, it does become more difficult to try and find a perfectly matched adult donor. So what we find on the register, and you can see this on statistics through the World Maradonor Association's website, globally, everyone's growing their registers year on year, and we can see the total number of available donors globally. Mm. We see the relative growth of common HLA types. So this is where we've got people like myself, who's quite a common HLA type, that part of the register will be constantly enriched. And then you can also see the number of singlets, or where that is the first ever unique HLA type that's ever been put onto a register. And that frequency is relatively high. So what we don't know is whether those people do actually have a potential match. It may be a case that they are the only person in the world with that HLA type. Mm. And that's obviously a challenge when you want to try and find a stem cell match for somebody, right. Where and it may not always be possible to get a perfect match. Mm. And that's the importance of different graft sources and different treatment types as well. So cord blood is a fantastic alternative, there's the use of PTCy in transplant now, for example. That's also overcoming some of the complications of mismatch. But of course, again, this is where a lot of cell therapies are focused on as well, to be able to give either mobilize the patient's own immune system so you don't have that complication, or have a transient treatment that will eradicate the cancer or the condition and not having any long-lasting effect like a transplant often does.
And this transplant network, you described it as a global one. I mean, I know I had interviewed Lucien Lewis Jones, whose son Opie had a transplant, bone marrow transplant, I think, from a donor in New Jersey, in the U.S. And so this network that you plug into is a global one, where you're able to look for donors pretty much anywhere in the world where there are these databases. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, there's registries in many countries. The World Maradonor Association is the organization which we all work within. So yeah, there's a global network with I think it's around 36 million donors globally that are registered to donate their material now,
and then you grow in every year, as you said. So I'm assuming if someone's interested in donating or becoming a donor, they can go to your website. And
absolutely, there's joining criteria. Obviously, we want to make sure that we're joining people who are joining our register are obviously fit and healthy and able, and also to ensure that we're getting donors that are going to meet the transplant need as well. So those that are going to provide the best chance for the patient to survive.
That leads me on to my next question, which is really about that, the challenges around kind of finding donors you know, when we talk about allogeneic therapies and their promise, it's really a lot of it is thinking about how we've grown up as a biopharmaceutical industry and making large batches of biologics or other, you know, medications or therapies and getting the economies of scale of doing so. And it's not clear to me how that exactly translates over into this idea of, you know, donors for cell-based therapies. And so I'd love to kind of just understand a little bit about the challenges that you foresee, you know, kind of making the leap to allogeneic cell therapies. You know, the way I describe it is that you can't have someone hooked up like, you know, they're hooked up in the matrix, just constantly donating T cells. It probably doesn't work that way. So I'd love to understand how it works. And as I understand it, there's a large vetting process that, you know, maybe, you know, again, referencing some data I saw from Be The Match where they need to look at 100 different potential donors to find one or candidates to find one donor. So tell us a little bit about the kind of the math of the scale of what you guys are doing.
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right. It is a complicated supply chain. Whilst there are therapies that are being developed that do look at creating multiple batch products for off-the-shelf delivery, this is still a very different type of industry to small molecule or even biologics, where you can batch and release on a scale. That's unlikely to happen in this regard. And so I think there are some very important things for consideration as we grow out the allogeneic donor use. First of all, I think the donors are amazing. They are doing something altruistic, and they are supporting the development and the delivery of new scientific advances and ultimately having a fantastic impact on patients. So I think first thing that we need to do is bring them on the journey with us. So celebrate the involvement that they have and the impact that they are having on patients. I think that is, you know, quite fundamental and quite amazing. I give the example of what was published quite recently, and I'm sure you would have seen it in the papers from Great Ormond Street. The little girl, Elisa, who received the base edited CAR T product.
Yes.
Absolutely phenomenal, absolutely amazing. So that combination of that fantastic science from the Institute of Child Health, from Wasim Kassim and his group, is absolutely brilliant. The combination of that with the life-saving donors ultimately was what was required to be able to deliver that therapy to her. Not only was a donor material used for the base edited CAR T product, she also received two bone marrow transplants. So the first bone marrow transplant hadn't worked. That was the traditional therapy, which then she went on to the base edited CAR T. And then that put her into remission, which is when she received another bone marrow transplant as well. So there were three donor products that was also used to save that little girl's life, which is absolutely phenomenal and amazing. Mm-hmm. And so it's absolutely crucial for me to make sure that we scale this donor element and this donor aspect in a way that is strong, robust, resilient. And first part of that is communication with our donors. And we need to take care of the donors and make sure that donor welfare is a significant consideration in the industry.
I mean, is it really a supply side challenge? I mean, it sounds to me like the demand is almost unlimited. I don't know, maybe it's not unlimited, but there's a lot of utility we can see for these types of products, these kinds of donations. You know, how do we go about stimulating that supply, and how do you guys go about, you know, donor awareness and managing these donors and patient advocacy and some of the things that you do to really kind of try and balance that equation?
Yeah. So from the donor side, we try to communicate as much. There's a lot of donor involvement in our processes, Anthony Nolan. So we have an ANSI group, what we call an ANSI group, an Anthony Nolan community involvement. We have donor involvement and donor groups, which we use to help inform our decisions and our processes and our journeys. And we have a specific cell and gene therapy donor group. So donors who have donated for research purposes, and we engage with them an awful lot because as an organization, we are our donors are part of us. They're part of our organization. They line up and they adopt our vision and our purpose, and they're as part of it as much as we are or are employed by the organization. So it makes perfect sense to us that donors are an integral voice that we listen to and we incorporate. In terms of the mechanics, we ensure that we've got a proportion of donors who are well characterized for research and donor for research purposes. So often research donors, researchers require different characterization of donors, whether that's an enhanced medical history or whether that's different type of cell phenotype, for example. We try to maintain a pool of warm donors who we can who are quick to respond. Mm-hmm. And so we have regular contact with them, regular conversations, and we're able to engage with them in a very responsive way. And I think that's really key and important. We grow that pool as the demands from the upstream market require. So as the industry grows, as the demand for more donor materials grow, we grow that warm donor pool. So we manage a community of people who are going to be very responsive, so as we can help meet those supply chains. Because it's, like I said, it's a complicated supply chain. It's complicated up the top and it's very complicated down the bottom. So when you consider the requirements of clean room space, scheduling of staff, that just-in-time delivery of that material is really, really critical. Mm-hmm. If somebody isn't available to donate on a Tuesday, that can have a significant impact on the rest of the schedules downstream. Yeah. So that coordination piece is really so important. So we do an awful lot to manage that. And as you mentioned, the from the Be The Match and what they've said, that sometimes you need to screen 100 people to find one person with the right phenotype that's necessary. That is challenging, but it's not impossible. And because of organizations like ours, like Be The Match, like Anthony Nolan, we have large donor pools of people who are signed up, consented, and we're able to go to and screen for further desirable characteristics if necessary.
Interesting. So if I'm interested in becoming a donor, can you describe what the process is? Like how long does it take and what challenges are there in getting it done?
Yeah. So only because you told me that you were born in 1974, so we have an age cutoff for donors on our register. So we accept donors between the ages of 16 and 30. So that's to join the register, of course. People mm-hmm. will sit on the register for quite some time before they're selected for a transplant. So sure. We actually will collect donor cells up until a donor is 60. Mm-hmm. But like I say, we've got 850,000 people on our register, and we constantly replenish and replace what falls off, and it is still in a growth phase. So we are growing. In terms of the journey for donation for materials, we'll engage with them first of all. So we'll contact somebody off of our register and say that we've got, if it's for a research donation, say that we've got an opportunity for, we're supporting research. We'll explain what we are as a cell and gene therapy services and the impact that the service is intending to have. And if they're interested in donating for research, it's a very open conversation. We give them an opportunity to ask us any questions as well. And then if they're still interested, we'll send them some information via email and we'll give them 48 hours to look through that and talk to the family and if they got any questions. And then we'll follow back up again. And if they're interested to become a donor for research, we'll book them in for a medical. So they'll have a blood test drawn for to look for any infectious disease markers, and then they'll be seen by a doctor, and we'll do a full medical. We'll do biochemistry tests and, mm-hmm. and the standard tests that you'd have done at a medical examination. Mm-hmm. If the donor is fit and well and they still want to donate, they will then sit on our donor panel. And that's where they'll be part of that community who's getting regular information about the different types of projects that we're providing material to and the impact that that's having. If there's a project comes up and they're selected, we'll contact them, we'll arrange the collection date. And then depending on the type of collection that it is, so it'll either be a donor leukocyte collection or it'll be a peripheral blood stem cell collection. So mm-hmm. if it's a peripheral blood stem cell collection, we'll arrange for them to be mobilized with GCSF. We usually do this with either in the hospital, they come to the hospital for the injections, or we can arrange for a nurse to visit them at home or at work. So it's not going to interfere with their life too much. And they'll receive GCSF for 4 days before the collection. In both scenarios, they go to the collection site on the morning of the collection. They'll be greeted. They'll have an opportunity to have a talk again about the procedure and what's going to happen. They'll be reconsented to say that they're happy to progress. And then they'll be put onto an apheresis collection machine. So mm-hmm. essentially, one needle in each arm. Blood will come out one side, it will go through the machine, they'll isolate the white cells, and then the remaining blood and plasma will be put back into the other arm. The process will take between 2.5 hours and 4 hours. And then after that, the blood is packaged, counted, and then one of our couriers will come and collect it and take it to its destination. The donor will receive a visit from Anthony Nolan. They'll receive a little thank you pack, and then they're free to go home. We'll follow up with them after a couple of days and make sure that they're still fit and well, and if they've got any problems or any concerns. And we've got a helpline if they've got any questions in the future as well. And then we'll maintain connection and conversation with them as well through our normal mailing list or however medium they prefer to be contacted with.
Yeah, it sounds similar to donating platelets or something.
Exactly.
Along those, that elk.
Yeah. Very, very similar.
Great. Thanks for that. So I guess all of us 31 plus year olds might be out of luck if we're not already on the list. Is that unfortunately?
Yeah. So yeah, Anthony Nolan did a lot of research some years ago that looked at the effect of the donor age on transplant outcome. Mm-hmm. And so the chances of survival from a younger donor is higher. So we had conversations at the time and we wanted to be able to open up those younger collections and have people from the age of 16 join our register. Mm-hmm. Again, people usually sit on the register for several years before they're collected. But it's a great opportunity to engage with young people, usually at sixth form and that kind of thing. And yeah, we get great sign up and enthusiasm from young people. So it's great. But yeah, the it's not to exclude anyone over the age of 30. It's more of a case that the scientifically there was benefit. So we put our investment into the younger populations. There are other registers that do accept higher. So I think DKMS UK, for example, they'll take donors up to the age of 35 or 40. But there are still other ways to donate as well.
It's a very nice way of telling me that I'm still too old, but I appreciate the thinking about it. You've just discussed a lot of ways in which you collaborate with the industry, with public sector, with schools, it sounds like, with donors, with patients, hospitals, I assume, but also the private sector, I'm assuming, with therapy developers. Could you tell us a little bit more about those kind of various collaborations or collaboration opportunities that you do, particularly with the private sector, or maybe that, I don't know how it works where obviously you've got a research institute internally. I'm guessing you're feeding research at academia or in academia, and maybe in the private sector as well. Would love to kind of better understand that.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I think the collaborating with the industry for me is really, really key and really important. There's a significant part of the process which we can control as a donor organization. And I've had many, many conversations with people in the industry and collaborators who are give us their specification, their starting cell specification. So they want particular characterization and particular cell number, CD34 number, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because they want to be able to control their design space. So it's, you know, following quality by design. They can control the incoming product. They know where the design space is, and then later on they'll close it down in their control space. But what I try to encourage them to do is actually bring us into that design space. So the variability, what exists out in donors, what can be controlled, you actually want to bring that into your design space and use it to your advantage. Mm. So a lot of the things that we do and a lot of the collaborations, and we do this through our research institute as well, is we try to bring that in as a research partnership almost. So what are the outcomes, what are the impact that you're wanting your cell product to have, and how can we manipulate, control the donor variables to be able to help you meet that need? How can we optimize that and not close it down so quickly? So let's keep it in the design space and let's test it. Yeah. I think the best example of that is work that we've done with ONK. Mm-hmm. So in Galway, they've partnered with our research institute, and it's a cord-based product. So mm-hmm. we're looking to understand how we can look at the variability of cord, look at the donors that the material is coming from, and look to see how we can characterize and predict the use of those cells further down the line. So, and I think that's where it does take that kind of proper partnership. I think to know the cause and the effect. So if we do something on our side, on the collection side, what impact does that have on your specific therapy?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously trying to minimize variability, and what's an obviously variable, inherently variable starting material. So I know Chris and his team at ONK, they're doing some great work there.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You want to be able to reduce the variability, and it's at the right time in my mind. So mm-hmm. it's when, what do you include for consideration in your design space, and how do you balance that to then define what your product profile is, right. And then how do you employ your processes to your process controls to manage that, and there's what I find sometimes in some conversations that I've had is that there's a desired product profile, material profile, mm-hmm. As opposed to a scalable one. So what is possible? So right. it may be a case that we're actually dealing to try and remove some variability early on, which makes it very difficult, very costly, which actually you might be able to deal with that further downstream, and vice versa.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to unnecessarily limit your options too early.
Yeah.
The options open. That makes sense. And I think, you know, we have seen some reasonably good data on NK cells in sort of the allogeneic format, or some coming out of MD Anderson and a few other places. And we've touched on the challenges a little bit. You know, we talked about graft versus host, and, you know, we know that some of the early allogeneic therapies, at least in clinical research, have suffered from some potency or durability challenges. How do you think, you know, what is the path that you see forward to try and bring some of these products to patients at scale? I mean, we know that currently, because of manufacturing limitations and other things, that the ability to scale autologous therapies has been a challenge, and we still have very high cost of goods and high cost products. Part of Ori's mission is to really try and solve that problem initially, is to say, how do we create mass personalization? How do we create products that are widely available, but are still personalized to an individual patient from an autologous therapy perspective? What's it going to take for us to get allogeneic therapies to market, do you think? How far away is it? How big are the hurdles that we're facing? Because a lot of the investment, you know, well, not a lot, you know, less than a third, but there's still been a significant amount of investment put into allogeneic as a way to try and solve the access challenge and the cost of goods challenge. But we still have significant clinical and scientific challenges. So I wonder what your view is of how we get from here to there.
I think it's an interesting one, but there's been a question in the industry of, you know, what's ultimately going to win out, auto, allo, or immortalized. You know, people are starting to consider kind of immortalization strategies, so as and remove the complications of allo as well.
Mm-hmm. When I talked to Bruce Levine about this, I asked him the same question, and a lot of times it is positioned kind of, is it auto, is it allo? And pretty much every thought leader I've spoken, you know, of Bruce's peer group, they say it's both. You know, we've proven out autologous, it's clinically effective, we can actually do the treatment, we can cure patients. We've just struggled in making them widely available, making them cost, you know, low cost, but we'll get there. You know, we just keep, you know, some indications, some products will always work better in an autologous format. Others, you know, like we were just talking about, maybe NK cell types and some of the things that they can do well might be quite effective in an allogeneic format. So I think maybe the answer is we don't know yet. You know, we're still on the early part of this journey, and there's green shoots on both sides of the argument to say that actually both modalities might have find their place. But I don't know if you, what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, you answered it beautifully. So, yeah, I think there is probably scalability issues that exist in the allogeneic area, and the ability to have access to the right donor source that can be challenging. So, if the development requires mass screening of donors, for example, it's similar to what we do from a transplant perspective, there's a significant amount of infrastructure that exists there or that's required to be able to deliver that and scale that. It exists in the transplant setting, so maybe it's a case of leveraging the expertise and the organizations that exist in that kind of tangential area to be able to support. But yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I don't think there's going to be one that wins out. I think it will be a combination of different different treatment types. I think the auto area has got significant promise, as you say, from to bring down the cost of manufacturing, and there's a lot of people working on that, yourselves included, mm-hmm. And it's that will have a significant impact to be able to scale and deliver it at pace globally. So I think we'll probably see that continue, and that will have an impact relatively quickly, I think. Mm-hmm. The allogeneic also has so if you can produce multiple products from single donor sources, for example, mm-hmm. then you start to have an economy of scale, I guess, because then you get back to your batch production kind of perspective. So yeah. Each donor process results in multiple different medicinal products. So, and that brings down the cost that way. I think it's, yeah, two very different approaches to get to the same endpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're all shooting for wide accessibility and, you know, affordability. So that's, yeah. we're not that fussed about how we get there. But I think, you know, one thing I haven't ever seen, you know, I think everyone immediately jumps to this, makes this mental leap to say we're going to go from today's processes to these, to like antibody-based, you know, 10,000-liter stir tank bioreactor kind of producing millions of doses. There's a massive amount of ground between here and there to get to where we might have a couple doses, you know, 3 or 5, and then we might go from 10 to 20, and then we might go to from 20 to, you know, 50, and you know, but there is a limitation to, these are still human cells we're talking about. They're not antibodies, and there's a certain kind of limitation about how big we could potentially go. And, you know, I don't know that to your point around, you know, donor sourcing, donor material handling, the kind of complexity and cost associated with that, that we'll see massive reductions in cost of goods immediately. You know, I think there's a journey that both of these modalities are on that we have to kind of see through to the end before we can get to that endpoint of widespread access. The other thing that you mentioned that I think is super interesting is kind of leveraging the regenerative medicine or transplant kind of learnings and network and expertise. There's a big debate, as you know, in cell therapy or advanced therapies about this kind of idea of distributed manufacturing. Could we potentially make products for patients on site at the hospital or somewhere nearby versus flying cells halfway across the world and to some centralized facility? I think we all sort of intuitively understand the benefits of a potential approach like that. I don't think any of us really fully understand the complexities, but you know, the regulator, both the MHRA and the FDA, have signaled a willingness to try and help figure this out because they can also see the benefits of certainly the logistical kind of vein-to-vein time benefits. What are your thoughts on, you know, I often have a debate about kind of in cell therapy or advanced therapies, like where are we on the continuum between regenerative medicine, you know, transplant medicine on this end, and, you know, biopharma manufacturing for small molecules all the way on this end? Like if they're two polar ends, you know, my guess is we'll probably end up somewhere in the middle, maybe even closer to regen med than we are, you know, to traditional biopharma manufacturing. I don't know if you have a view on that.
Yeah, I think I probably agree with you. I think it probably will move to that side, but supported and supplied by robust manufacturing. So again, similar to what we have in the transplant setting. So you're right, the question between centralized and decentralized has been going for a long time. And in all of the industries and what we see, whether it's building a car or manufacturing toothpaste, what we have is a segmented manufacturing. So centers of excellence who can produce elements at scale for a relative cost, they emerge and they become leaders in that. So, and we've seen this already with like viral vector production.
I was going to say vector, media, cytokines, all those things are generic to the process and can be done in bulk.
Yeah. Exactly. So, and I think what we'll find is that you have other relevant elements of that. So one of the things that we're working on here at Anthony and Ellen and the Cell Therapy Center in Nottingham is understanding how we might be able to provide well-standardized starting materials, well-characterized, stored and off the shelf. So moving into that manufacturing space slightly. So rather than providing the raw material, how do we provide the isolated CD34 cells that are well-characterized for the purpose and the need that it's needed further downstream? The idea being that you then bring all of those elements together, your media, your vector, and your cell type, into a vessel which then can complete the manufacturing, whether that's done at the hospital or whether it's done close to or in a sub-center in like the UK or whatever it might be. I'm not entirely sure, but I don't see why having that close to the bedside wouldn't be possible. I think, as you say, if all of those other feeding parts are well regulated, well controlled, then you can still control that control space can still be well defined, and I think you'll still be able to get a defined product profile out the end of it. But the delivery to the patient will be very much like in the hospital setting. So and that marrying up of preparation of the product and the delivery, I think, could sit very similar to what transplant is, and that's under the supervision of their clinician.
Yeah. I was reading an article, maybe it was last week or week before, about I want to say it was a hospital in the US doing outpatient CAR T therapy. Which is, you know, a big step forward. Obviously, if you look at the cost breakdown for, let's just use the US as an example, for CAR T therapy, it's, let's call it $500,000 for some of the commercially available products. That's another $1 million of hospital costs.
Yeah.
So if we can start to standard, you mentioned standards, which, you know, we're on the very early part of the journey in advanced therapies to support standards, but if we can start to standardize some of these pieces and to bring down the risk of, you know, cytokine release and some of these other things, you know, massive adverse events associated that require hospitalization, if we could do it in an outpatient setting, that would be a massive step forward.
Totally agree. I think we'd have to approach that with caution, though, to the point made previously around different obstacles for patient access. Mm. So ensuring that there is robust infrastructure to support outpatients as well. Mm. I think that will be really, really key.
For sure. Are there other standards or kind of regulatory innovations that you would like to see happen or foresee happening that would be beneficial to try to solve some of these problems or to overcome some of the challenges that you guys face as a charity?
From a regulatory perspective, I think there are a number of key areas. Something which I'm sure everyone talks about is the alignment of regulations. And this isn't a localized industry. That also happens to be sitting next to a European industry and an American industry. These are integrated industries. So yes. The regulations really do need to align so as we can make sure that the borders aren't barriers and make sure that when a therapy developer has an innovation in the US, for example, that we can deliver that to patients here as quickly as possible. Yeah. I think I speak about it in team meetings here. The only thing worse than not having a curative treatment is having a curative treatment you can't access. Mm. You know, and that's what Shirley Nolan had in the first place. The reason she set up the organization was there was a treatment option available for her son, but she just couldn't access it.
Must be so frustrating as a parent. Yeah, I can't imagine.
Absolutely. So I think that's really key, and there's a role for regulators to play to ensure that we can scale at pace and no patient dies in between from when the innovation has been created to approved and the ability to deliver it. Mm. There's a role for the regulators for sure, and for organizations like ours and mm. RE Biotech. And I know this is very certainly a vision for you guys.
Yes.
is to ensure that you can scale this on a global level, and nobody misses out in the in between bits. I think that's really critical. The other thing for me from a regulatory perspective is donors. They're so important to us as an organization. They are part of our organization. They're integral members of our teams. But the regulations, there's not too much in the regulations that protect donor welfare. Mm. That's really strange that I want a regulator to regulate me. I think it's really, really important. The Human Tissue Authority in the UK has great standards in place that ensures the safety and efficacy of the materials for the patient. And there are some elements of the regulations which do cover the donor. But I think there's a lot more that we could probably do in this area. I'd like to see, I think it would be the role of a regulator to stand up and kind of challenge us and say what is appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know the industry was, concerned about, some of the rising up of unregulated, stem cell clinics and other things like that. And there was a court ruling, I think, was it in California that raised the eyebrows of the industry that made us very concerned that, and the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine, who we're a member of, really said, it needs to be regulated. It needs to ensure that, GXP is followed and that we've got, all the necessary protections in for donors in your case or patients or both. So I would agree with you, a smart amount of regulation makes sense. And I actually was reading another article recently where there was some prediction, I forget how far off in the future it was, where an approval, a regulatory approval in the US would mean an approval, I think it was in the UK or in Europe. That kind of additional regulatory, what I would argue would be potentially a redundant process. Certainly every country would have its ability to decide, market access and pricing and all those other things and negotiate with the innovators. But is it really necessary to have two regulators look, or three or four or five, yeah, depending on how many actually look at it, if you're going to Japan and Australia and, the EMA, et cetera. So there's definitely some regulatory innovation that could help smooth access for patients, which I think is what we all want. I agree with you. So we're coming to about to our end of our time together. And thanks again for spending an hour or so with us. A question I like to ask all my guests, because I always hope that their crystal ball works better than mine. But I'd love to know your ambition for the industry over the next 5 to 10 years. What do you see kind of coming to the fore? What kinds of innovations, what kinds of challenges that we will hopefully be able to overcome? What's your hope for where we are 10 years from now?
Sure. No, it's a great question. I think the crystal ball element is, I think it's really, really difficult. I really do. Not necessarily for the direction, but the pace that it works at. I think that's where we're working at a unpredictable pace. So I don't know whether some of the things that we think will come to fruition in 10 years or is it 50 years? I really don't know. But from my perspective, I think there are so two different areas, I guess. So 5-10 years time from a patient perspective and a treatment perspective, I expect that we'll see the things that start to come to fruition. The long pipeline of products that are being developed, we'll start to see them being delivered. I think that's probably going to drive some real challenges. It's really going to pressure test the systems of scalability and delivery. And I think we're probably going to butt up against some real challenges on the ability to pay, which I'm hopeful that will also help drive investment into systems that can help reduce the cost and help ultimately overcome some of those hurdles. So I think it's going to be from a patient delivery perspective, it'll be a challenging 10 years, but I think we will push through it and we'll start to see patients benefiting much more widely from cell and gene therapies. From a discovery perspective, so I think we'll probably see that the science starts to change, and we start to move away from a dependence, as I mentioned earlier, on autologous and allogenic, I think, and we'll start to see, and we've already seen it in the industry anyway, the move to immortalized cells, iPSCs, and kind of universal donor type materials. I think that's the future that you suggest that you get to with the big biotank. I think that's where that'll be in discovery, I think, at that point. As well as a move away from cellular materials, actually. And I think it'll be really interesting to watch over the next 5 to 10 years what happens in the mRNA, the DNA, and the RNA technologies. I think that could change quite significantly as well. And we start to see, I think the growth of vaccines over the next 5 to 10 years and the science and the investigation in the discovery phase of those, I think it can be really, really interesting.
Yeah. I think it's a great note to end on with kind of our ambition for lots of patients getting treated, you know, widespread access, lots of innovation coming down. I think we are all hopeful that things like in vivo CAR T or, you know, iPS derived therapies or even cancer vaccines. You know, we've heard a lot of research going on about that. That would be beneficial for you and I as human beings, but the industry as a whole. So love your ambition and agree that, you know, that we're going to be hopefully positive contributors to helping the industry get there. So Daniel, thanks again so much for spending your time with us and for educating us about the great work that Anthony Nolan's doing, and look forward to our continued partnership in the future.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk.
Thank you for listening to the Ori Spotlight podcast. To keep up with the latest in cell and gene therapy and follow us on our mission to manufacture brighter futures for patients, head to the show notes to follow us on social media or visit us at oribiotech.com.